10 a.m. and we'll go ahead and call the meeting to order of the Tax Relief for Pollution Control Property Advisory Committee. And I'm showing that the ones that are absent are Lloyd, Cyrus, and Charles is supposed to be on the line, but he might be a couple of minutes late. So everyone else is present. So I'll go ahead and the policy generally is for anyone from the audience is welcome to speak as long as we just have a reasonable time limit. We don't have an exact time limit for you, but you're welcome to participate anytime during the meeting, and we'll have time at the end and give you another chance to speak up. So any general comments from the committee before we get started? Before we start, I thought I would introduce a new staff member. So Shelley has agreed to come forward or speak from there. Or
okay.
Probably go to the mic if you don't mind.
Okay, sure.
Go ahead and introduce yourself and your position now.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Shelley Nike. I'm new to the Prop 2 team, taking Chance Gooden's place since he's moved to another division. So I'll be working with Ron and Alyssa. I've been with the TCEQ a little over 5 years, working on state implementation planning, stationary source rule writing. Prior to that, I worked for about 7 years as a process engineer in the petrochemical industry in Houston. So that's me, and I'm looking forward to meeting everyone I haven't met yet and looking forward to working with you.
All right, great. Thanks, Shelley. We'll have now, as you're probably aware, there were three public meetings that were training, so we'll let Ron give an update or a report from those training sessions.
Hi, I'm Ron Hatlett with the Tax Relief Program. We did three training seminars. The purpose was to provide information and history on the program, to explain how to fill out an application, and to explain how to respond to a notice of deficiency letter. The three meetings were here on November 18th, where we had 18 registered attendees, Houston on December 2nd, where we had 19 registered attendees, and Fort Worth on December 4th with 20 registered attendees. At each meeting, there were several additional people who either came in late or came in through a different door and didn't register. So the actual number is probably closer to 70 to 75 people. Of the ones who did sign in, we ran the numbers after we got back, and they were responsible for 54% of the applications that were filed in the last 3 years. So we think even with the short notice on the meetings, we reached a considerable large portion of the people who actually work with us on a year-in and year-out basis. It'd be interesting to see if that makes any change on quality of applications or quality of NOD responses this year. Any questions? Oh, and I gave you copies of the handout. It's online. If you go to our section of the webpage, you can get the full-size presentation. You don't have to try and read it off the 6 slides to a sheet.
Thank you, Ron.
You're welcome.
All right. For the record, Lloyd Graham has arrived. Welcome, Lloyd.
Let's fun begin.
Yeah. I have on the agenda also the draft annual report. Our bylaws, the committee bylaws, require us to have an annual report of our committee. And actually, the legislation requires us to be able to be of report our use back to the commission. So we'll be doing that, and I envision voting on that report at our next meeting. And basically, it'll be a report of very similar to the last year's format. And I'll get the draft out to you before our next meeting, and I need to get information on the travel costs and some of that after the end of the year. So I'll be getting that from Ron or someone from TCEQ. So that's just more of a heads up, and if you have any concerns about it, I'll try to send a draft out in plenty of time for you to have any responses back or concerns. But that's our annual report we plan to do. And speaking of our next meeting, I guess I could cover it further down at the end, but I'll go ahead and say My preference is to try to have it in February, and the only motive is tax season is coming up for a lot of people, and March and April tends to get very busy, so we're required to meet once a quarter. So I'd like to meet sometime in February. I'll send dates out to you. Ideally, this is a little bit selfish, but I'll be in Austin, I think the 24th and 25th. So the 26th would be an ideal time, but we'll talk. I'll send out other dates. So I realize that's not good for everybody. So I already see one conflict. So all right, we'll work around that. The 26th, I believe, which is a Friday. 26th
of February.
February.
Thursday.
Yeah. Maybe it's the
27th
would
be Friday.
Yes, 27th. That's what I'm thinking of.
Good morning. This is Charles Allred.
Hi, Charles. Thanks for joining us.
Hey. How y'all doing?
I think for some of us who are involved in the legislative process, Fridays at that point are important for us.
Okay.
Important that we leave for Fridays.
Okay. All right. Is Friday, is that better? Well, we'll work that out later. Okay.
That week, that closing out week.
Okay. Oh, I got you. Okay. All right.
You're closing out?
Yeah.
Well, then can we get this away for this
guy? No.
He's not closing out on the committee, by the way, right?
Yeah.
I think he'll continue to do his term.
I still want him in his office down in Jefferson.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Next item, I have implications, and this is just because it was a news item in industry, and I don't know how much TCEQ wants to comment on it, but any implications of the U.S. EPA approval of the state implementation plan for greenhouse gases. Ron, Shelley, anyone want to comment on that, or mine, or anybody else? Okay, all right. I understand.
I'm not prepared.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll just move past on that. I think we will have some more discussion, I understand, on this next item. So don't get excited. We're not leaving in the next 10 minutes, I don't think. So if actually this is an item that was brought up two or three meetings ago, and we talked about bringing or getting some more discussion on this, and we're not intending to have it, at least I'm not hoping we won't have a vote today. That's not where we're going with this at all, but it's a discussion item that's been brought to my attention. So and you have it in front of you, and Mike Nancy is the one that has prepared that, so I'll let him take it from here.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah, to be clear, in our couple meetings ago, maybe three meetings ago, we had three recommendations, two of which we tabled, one of which we adopted as it related to the proposed rule at the time. One of those items did address this issue, and so in our call, I said that I would do some additional work on that concept and bring it to the committee. It didn't occur, it didn't seem to me that giving it to y'all in email and then trying to have a vote was the right way to do it. I figured we'd just have a layout, talk about it. You guys can take all the time you need to study on it and give thoughts and input over email between now and our next meeting, and then maybe we take action at the next meeting if there's a majority of folks that want to take action on it. So it's really designed to start a dialogue. But I'll, toward that end, I'll give you some. I kept it to one page. The rationale could be a little longer, and it could provide some examples. And I certainly am prepared to do that for y'all if it would help. What I did was I talked to a couple members of the committee and some of the taxpayers that we represent to get a sense of where there could be clarity about this issue of what is meter exceed an environmental rule. And one important qualification of this discussion is we may come to agreement about what this hurdle or, you know, qualifying criteria means or should mean, but that doesn't speak to what the commission's going to do as it relates to the application as a whole. It may disqualify the item for different reasons. It may significantly reduce the positive use determination under Tier 3. This is a very rifle shot analysis of, we have this gatekeeper provision about whether there's an adequate environmental rule. And so what I did was craft, you know, some of this language is familiar because it was a shorter version in that recommendation that we laid out a few meetings ago, but I'll just take you through it. Everybody should have a copy of it. And this could be five different things, but I think it was better to organize it as one with three subsets and then two and three, and I'll explain why. And actually, the GHG issue comes up here, so you'll see. The idea would be for the committee to suggest to the commission, and the commission could take that anywhere it wanted to. It could say, that's nice, we disagree. Or it could say, that's nice, we'll consider it in a rulemaking. Or that's nice, we'll roll it into our guidance. Or we like some of what you have to say. I mean, I'm not predisposing what the commission does with this, but I'm hoping that we can have a meeting of the minds of about some aspects of this language here. So the first, so there's three situations that seem to have come up that have created the issue of, is that an environmental rule, and that would, you know, at least get the facility or the equipment into the system for consideration. And the corollary, is that something, because it's not qualifying as an adequate environmental rule, that will keep the equipment from even being considered? And so I've got three situations here in the first. And one is this general standard issue that we've talked about from time to time. The most obvious example recently was water conservation, but we've also talked about pollution prevention. Things like, you know, the fact that best management practices that are installed at a facility that prevent stormwater runoff, right, may not be directed by that general pollution control, pollution prevention standard, but we think that they should be, that equipment should at least be eligible for consideration under the program. The second is in the situations where, and this is, you know, there's a lot of different hypotheticals that play into this, but the most obvious is when somebody is installing something, and because they install something, they don't trigger a threshold. Air quality is a perfect example. Robert's industry has this happen a lot. Every industry that's represented, certainly on the industry side, has these things where the commission has permitting thresholds, the federal government has thresholds, that if you install certain equipment, you're actually not going to have to, you know, go into a more complex or more complicated permitting situation. Or if you, you know, install a piece of equipment and put operational conditions on it, you might not even trigger an additional regulatory set of requirements. And that's kind of an area that's in, you know, it's hard for the commission to grapple with, because there the environmental rule is not directing that the equipment be installed, right? But it's clearly the installation is driven by the desire to reduce pollution and, you know, and meet certain criteria. And so it's just kind of a classic example. The Constitution passes language, the statute, the legislature passes language, and all these infinite hypotheticals can't be predicted. And the commission's been doing its best job to try to harmonize how it integrates the program with these general principles. And remember, the statute just generally says the environmental rule, that the equipment meets or exceeds an environmental rule, right? So the real question has come up, what does exceed mean? And the commission's taken a safe approach of saying exceed at least means that if the standard was 80% control and you do 95, that qualifies. That's pretty safe, and I think that, you know, that made sense, and but it's been harder for them to make that determination in these other situations, doing it sooner or doing it to avoid a trigger or a threshold. So that's what subsection B, and my intent today is not to flesh out all the hypothetical details. I may come back to help make more complete your consideration of this language and give you some examples of each of these so you can kind of study on them and think about them. But at least in the intro here, I'm just going to try to hit the high points. That's B. And then in C, this is one of these things, and Ben and I had a brief exchange about this when we considered that language a few meetings ago, and that is the environmental rule has been formally proposed at the time the application is filed and the equipment is installed, presumably, that if finalized would actually constitute a rule that would otherwise meet the commission's test for meet or exceed. But I made it clear that in order to maintain the constitutionality of that action, it would need to condition the positive use determination that the rule actually does get finalized. But here what we have in the current environmental regulatory environment, certainly with my clients and in the utility industry, is there's so much onslaught of environmental rules that we will often need to, because we're not going to have enough time to install after the final rule, we'll need to initiate installations before the rule is finalized. We'll know that a certain amount of what needs to get done is probably not going to change in the rule, so we'll build at risk. We'll do that so that when the rule is actually finalized, we're not looking at a six-month time frame for a turnaround of, you know, getting a SNCR installed.
So an example that might hit close to home to my right, if you assume the proposed EPA federal haze rules actually go forward, withstand challenges, and a bunch of his of Luminant's coal plants are required to either put new scrubbers on or upgrade their existing scrubber under this third provision, they could go ahead and put it on, and once that becomes final, then something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's an easy example, actually. I acknowledge there might be not as easy examples. It may not be easy from a price of control. Paul might not like the easy characterization, but, you know, the goal here is we're not going to be able to solve all the legal disputes that happen on regs, but maybe we can come to some peace of mind that there's certain rules that if people go out and do some installations that we're not going to pull that rug out from underneath them just because the rule was proposed.
Can I ask a question, and it's prompted by the exchange you all just had and the example you just used. Under existing practices and rules, would those scrubbers be pollution control equipment now that they just talked about? We're saying yes.
They would. That's an easy example because SO2 is already controlled pollutant.
Maybe we should find
a better example.
A better example.
I got it. So let's just say the Hayes rule was regulating SO2, was regulating a new pollutant, some new magical pollutant. I mean, hypothetical is good, so we can understand. Is that if there's not currently a regulatory driver that would make Paul's property eligible, right? Whether it's because of the pollutant or whatever, and a rule gets proposed. I mean, greenhouse gases is the best example, and we're going to get to. There's two ways to think about greenhouse gases. One is very specifically as it relates to item two, and I'll talk about that. But let's just say somebody wanted to. There's a proposed 111D rule. For those of you who don't know, the EPA has proposed a rule to regulate greenhouse gases at electric generating facilities. They have editorial comment, highly illegal, overreaching regulatory proposal. But at the end of the day, some aspect of it may survive.
A common sense approach to reducing our global warming gases to meet the most important issue facing our society.
And if Cyrus's policy position is true,
this is the one
some aspect
about
of the rule may survive.
Yeah, I want to make sure I understand. This is the one we're reading about in the newspaper, right?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. So say a facility, because they're worried about, you know, what it will, you know, how much time they'll really have once a SIP is disapproved and a FIP is issued, just hypothetically, okay? Or a SIP is approved, for that matter, in a state that submits an approvable SIP. If they're trying to outpace the burden of getting that equipment installed, they may seek to install it sooner. And, you know, for pollutants that had heretofore not had a regulatory driver that would meet the criteria, it may present the commission with a difficult set of questions legally, and I'm just looking to preempt and simplify that analysis, knowing full well that to be constitutional, it has to be an adopted rule.
I got a question. This is not designed to expand back into from what a piece of equipment is into an entire process. For example, a wind turbine. If these rules pass, wind farm is going to be useful in meeting those rules as far as producing power. So you're not proposing taking the whole wind farm off the tax rolls. It's still a discrete piece of equipment. We're not expanding. Is that
not at all? No intent. And you know, and when we've dressed this language up, we ought to be real specific. You know, I think this committee did a great job of addressing with the Valero hypothetical situation, the hydrotreater language that would prevent that problem from recurring, right? And so we could do here something similar. There still is every once in a while some specter of, well, battery storage or windmills could be exempt, and that's not the intent here. The intent is where facilities have pollutants that they're seeking to control, and just because of the enigma of timing and legal challenges, there's uncertainty. If you know, we can give some guidance to the commission that we think it's safe within the Constitution and the statute to implement it in this way. That's the idea. And so that's 1C, and you know, I think to be constitutional, I'm not a constitutional scholar, but the fact is we're talking about a constitutional provision. We wouldn't ask the commission to issue a positive use determination that would have an effective date any sooner than the adopted date of the rule, because the Constitution says adopted, right? But to facilitate timeliness in the installation and really certainty for the people who are having to spend the hundreds of millions and sometimes billions of dollars to install equipment, we could get the process going based on a proposed rule so long as it was finalized. All right. And then if I'm going to jump to 3, because then we'll come back to greenhouse gases. 3 is a hypothetical that is very interesting that Robert Castor flagged, and I'll let him talk about it a little bit, if you want.
Yeah, so I think Therese was kind of pointing to a situation where, you know, a rule is adopted and a facility installs or acquires equipment to meet that rule, and then after getting the equipment installed, suddenly through a court ruling or something like that, the rule is thrown out. And so you have all of this equipment you installed to meet an environmental rule for pollution control purposes, and then suddenly there's no more environmental rule that dictates the installation of that equipment. I think it kind of ties to number 2 in the Supreme Court ruling related to greenhouse gas, and that, you know, my company specifically, many other semiconductor companies in the industry installed greenhouse gas pollution control equipment in regards to meeting or otherwise avoiding major source permitting applicability to lower emissions thresholds. And then the Supreme Court comes in and issues a ruling that effectively removes the requirement that we do any of that equipment installation. So, you know, we're looking at the potential of having, you know, tens of millions of dollars in equipment on the tax roll that, you know, was installed to meet an environmental regulation that doesn't exist anymore effectively, and we otherwise would never have installed.
Just a practical question. If something like that happened, would either the business be inclined just to get rid of that equipment, or would the taxable value of it drop down significantly? I'm just wondering if that's if there's a real tax burden to equipment that's no longer required. I don't know the answer to that. I'm just curious.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to the tax question.
It'd still be used, right?
It would still be used. You know, I'll say in my situation, it's taking just about every ounce of my effort to convince the company not to unhook that equipment and chunk it in a dumpster. You know, and I don't think that's in anyone's best interest. You know,
what is the equipment? Just I don't know.
It's a thermal oxidation device. It's on the tier one list. It's not required. It was done over the last year and a half to lower our greenhouse gas emissions, so that we didn't trigger Title V permitting.
So now you can take it out.
Can I ask a question similar to a previous question? Kind of thinking through the rules. Right now, if a property owner applies for a Prop 2 exemption, the Prop 2 exemption is granted. The regulatory rule that they cited is repealed or struck down by the courts, you don't take away the positive use determination, do you?
But have you? Or what about the situation where the application has not yet been filed for equipment that was installed prior to that Supreme Court decision?
That's the hypothetical.
Okay, so what would y'all do in that situation if they installed the property while the regulation was in place, then after the regulation was knocked out, they come to you and they say, we installed it while that regulation was in place? How did that play out?
I think we look to whether it's a valid adopted rule at the time of the commission action on the application.
Okay. So that would be a situation where the property would no longer be eligible for a positive use determination because the regulation is not on the books.
Right. And what I'm trying to accomplish here with the three qualifier and then the one I guess it's C, it's part of C. But I mean the idea is there may be windows where Robert's classic example is you act because you have you're trying to prepare for a compliance, and just because of the way the legal challenges work out, basically the commission is faced with a difficult call, and we as a committee might be able to refine some limited circumstances where, you know, at least we feel comfortable it would honor the statute and the Constitution if they continued to recognize it, because when it was installed, right, there was an adopted rule. Or when it was installed, there was a proposed rule that then was later adopted. Okay? And, of course, the effective date in that latter circumstance would need to be tend to be adopted. I mean, I'm much more concerned, honestly, with Robert's situation because of its punitive nature. But that's the idea here, is I've just started to hear. And the reason that these clarifications are important, Don, because you ask a good question, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Basically, we got a lot of very large equipment installations being considered within industry, and they're looking for all the certainty they can get about when I act, am I going to have, you know, what are the economics? Okay, this isn't the only thing that drives economics, but the taxable burden on property definitely plays into installation decisions in terms of timing. So if the idea is that somebody will do something a little bit sooner, there's clearly an environmental benefit to that, and does it undermine the legitimacy of the program? I think not, or at least we could maybe come up with language that would make sure we were all comfortable that it did honor the program.
Okay. Roland Bieber. What you talked about first, Mike, was a situation where the rule hasn't been, it's not in effect yet. A pollutant hasn't been deemed a pollutant. And you want to be able to make application and let them start working on, get that ball going. But it would not be, they would not issue a determination letter until the rule passed. Is that right?
I mean, I defer to the commission about how they'd like to do it. Clearly, it would not be effective until the adoption. Whether they decided to put that on the face of the positive use determination itself or hold it, I mean, that's really a question procedurally for another day. But I'm recognizing we can't be asking the commission to issue positive use determinations for rules that don't actually get to adoption. Even though, sadly, there's actually bad situations that can happen if a rule actually never gets to adoption. You've got somebody who installs equipment to be proactive, and then the thing never makes it. But, you know, that's the Constitution says adopted, so I'm trying to live within the limits of the law here.
So the difference between your scenario and Rob's scenario is that the rule is adopted and then turned around later.
Yeah, see, and I think that we're under safe ground constitutionally if the rule was adopted. And, you know, because, you know, whatever you want to say that rule, that language means, you know, the equipment was installed to meet or exceed an adopted environmental rule.
As far as Robert's, William Frizzell, Robert's idea, as long as the equipment is not something long existing that they put in before a rule passed, and then, you know,
This is a great situation where we would need to firm that up, Wayne.
Yeah.
I would agree.
Timing,
you would want to make
timing
sure
wise,
that this did not get abused. Absolutely.
Right. And the other thing is, in general, me personally, I don't, if it's purely a piece of pollution control equipment and it doesn't add to the economics of the company, then I'm not worried about it. You're not going to get me
sure,
fighting you on this. But
To be clear, Wayne, there will be equipment. Let's just go ahead and jump ahead. There will be equipment that will have mixed productive use. Okay, I don't have anything specific in mind. But that's what this is. This is, do they even get considered? Okay. Tier 3 will deal with the productive use.
Okay.
I'm talking about the gatekeeper provision, the commission's narrow job under the statute and the Constitution to evaluate as a gatekeeper provision. Am I even going to take up commission resources considering this equipment because there's not an environmental rule that meets the criteria?
Aren't we just talking about a timing issue here? Because the commission's already said that if the regulation goes away after you get your positive use, they're not going to take that
right off.
So really what you're talking about is if you started a project when there was a regulation, but before you could finish and get your use determination, it went away, whatever timing period that is, that's what you're trying to fix.
That's exactly right.
It's just a timing issue.
Exactly.
So it really needs to be when the application's made, not when the project is completed.
A determination letter issued?
Well, I mean, no, I don't think so, because the decision to install and the application date are different, and you know, I think the goal should be that, you know, when the equipment installation occurred, you know, what was the state of the rule? Right?
Yeah.
The statute and the Constitution doesn't tie the hands of the commission to link that to an application date.
Can applications be made in advance, Ron?
In advance of a rule
being adopted? In advance of putting the stuff in.
Finished.
Our policy is you can start an application.
Right.
As
soon as you start building something.
Hmm.
And that's the way you end up with construction in progress, tax rolls, paying taxes on something that should be exempt.
Which can be a pretty weighty number.
Or getting an exemption when the project died and then nothing ever came to be.
Right. And we've seen that. We've had applications that were.
Ron, would you mind going to the mic so we can get it on the record? Do you think we should?
That's why Bob's the chairman.
We've had applications that were filed. They were speculative. They were a paper company that was trying to. The paper company had been sold to a larger company, and they had a plant in Texas and a plant in Canada that did exactly the same thing. The U.S. plant was trying to justify converting to something else, and it only made economic sense if it was exempt. So they filed the application. What they told us was that they were going forward with the project. What we found out after we did the determination was that they never knew if they were going to go forward with the project, and they didn't. The plant closed down. So there was never actually an exemption granted, and that was when we enacted the rule that you have to actually have done something that causes taxable value. And as far as the rules changing, we had an issue a few years back with mercury controls at power plants where there was a mercury standard that had to be met. And then there was a new mercury rule that came out that the courts threw out. We couldn't accept the new rule, the one that the courts had rejected eventually, but all those applications qualified under the previous rule. And then there was a paper mill in Houston back in the mid-90s. There was a paper mill standard put out by EPA that had three potential methods in the proposal to meet the standard. By the time it was adopted, they only had two methods, but this paper mill in Houston had actually followed the third method and installed that equipment. We had granted them a positive use determination based on it looking like it was going to be adopted, but it wasn't in effect until it was adopted. Since it wasn't adopted, they didn't use the equipment, so the property never really went on the tax rolls, so it didn't really matter what we had done.
Yeah, I mean, in our situation, you know, we have several of these oxidation units that were installed within weeks of the Supreme Court ruling and are being used. In fact, are quite a hindrance on production because they're a maintenance nightmare. So they actually hurt our production. And The only thing going for myself as far as convincing manufacturing to keep this equipment running is that, you know, we'll likely end up with some other form of CO2 legislation that applies to our industry at some point down the road.
So in your case, have you already got, I mean, if this is too specific to you, it's okay. Have you already got your use determinations, or you haven't done that?
On some of them. Project's been going on for 18 months. So some of these units that were installed back in 2013, late 2013, have gotten positive use determinations. Since then, the ones that have been installed in 2014, an application has not been filed yet. So, you know, that's kind of the situation we're in is, you know, to go and now file that application, I there's not really.
So you do have this timing issue where there was a reg when you started. Now there's not because of the court actions, there's not a reg
right
for you to hang your hat on, and you already have the equipment on the ground operating.
Yep.
So that's an example of that. So then let me get back to two, because it's actually directly relates to this. It's what Robert was talking about. And I called it out as a specific item because, and I didn't include the language, and I should have in retrospect, from the statute, and I'm just going to read it into the record to get everybody familiar. It's K-16. And the language in K-16 says, if the U.S. EPA adopts a final rule or regulation regulating carbon dioxide as a pollutant, property that is used, constructed, acquired, or installed wholly or partly to capture carbon dioxide from an anthropogenic source in the state that is geologically sequestered in the state. So what that, just so you understand, that when that legislation was actually developed, that was House Bill 3732 in 2007, it came out of the House, it didn't have that qualifier on it. It just said carbon control and sequestration. And Ledge Council actually identified that there was a constitutional frailty there because, you know, carbon dioxide wasn't regulated as a pollutant at the time. And so this was added in the Senate. I mean, I watched it happen because of that. So there was some thought put in to the fact that there needs to be a hook, right, to be constitutional. And the reason it's important to call out that separately is, you know, and Cyrus, a good kick out of this, you know, I certainly think that CCUS projects are critically important, but my industry wants to be proactive. They want, you know, to address that issue, but they do not want to be forced to do it under regulatory regimes that are illegal. But that can't be confused with the fact that if somebody does a project, you know, it ought to be qualifying, okay? And wherever we were when the Air Products case was decided back, I think it was October, okay, you know, where we were, just so everybody who hasn't been tracking this daily is, we did not yet know what the law of the land was about whether carbon dioxide could be regulated as a pollutant, at least in the state of Texas's eyes and my eyes, because there was still a chance that the Supreme Court was going to rule, either undo the endangerment finding or in some way other curtail EPA's ability to regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant. Some would argue that issue wasn't before them, but whatever the status of the law was in October, I can see why the commission would make a decision like they did in Air Products, which was that the application there, okay, did not yet have an adequate rule, because the rule that was underpinning that assumption was being challenged and very much was open for question. And in the UARG decision, which came out at the beginning of this year, okay, some good things happened, some bad things happened, depending on who you're talking to. Cyrus and I would chuckle about that. But the thing, there were a lot of restrictions placed on what EPA could do. But one thing that was pretty settled in that court case, no matter who you represent, is that for any way sources, people who were going to need to get federal permits for other reasons, for pollutants, were going to be subjected to BACT, best available control technology evaluations, for carbon dioxide. And if you didn't prove that you were implementing BACT for carbon dioxide, EPA is therefore empowered to impose a restriction on carbon dioxide. So my view is, and I think it's important that we help the commission, give some advice to the commission about how they could view this, is to not take anything away from the legal challenges and the continued controversy associated with it, but
if somebody is actually going to move forward on a CCUS project, we should at least not be kicking them out of the program because of the environmental rule piece, because from here on out, VACT for GHGs is going to occur at anywhere sources. And upon the issuance, and this goes back to our agenda item, and I actually didn't ask for agenda item 4, but it was, you know, it's a naturally related issue. The state implementation plan for Texas to do the reviews for GHG permitting has now been approved and the FIP has been withdrawn. So now, current day, state of Texas is going to be doing greenhouse gas VACT reviews. Now, that doesn't mean that they will mandate in every instance, and hopefully not any instance, CCUS at a project. But the pollutant, to read directly from the statute, is regulated. Okay? They've adopted a final rule regulation that now has undergone scrutiny and has been upheld, okay, regulating carbon dioxide as a pollutant. And what I think is dangerous is the commission's in a situation where it's going to have to make calls about, okay, well, for that sector, is it a pollutant? Or for that sector, I mean, it's a pollutant. EPA is regulating. It's doing GHG reviews across all sectors if you're already in the program. Right, so for Robert, he's not already in the program. That's the reason he's got his hypothetical. But for electric generating facility, a refinery, if they're doing greenhouse gas reduction projects, you know, we can deal with them all day long on Tier 3, and you know, address those issues. But what we shouldn't be doing is kicking people out of eligibility because of an inadequate environmental rule argument. Okay, so I'm looking to try to give industry a little more certainty about how this program is going to accept them in through that gatekeeper. There's no assurance that you're going to get a positive use determination. You might be ineligible for other reasons. But we shouldn't be having a debate at this table, or the commission shouldn't necessarily have to grapple in this program anymore with the question of whether a CCUS project, or for that matter, other GHG reductions. I've been very specific to CCUS because this is a critical time period, I'll be very honest with you, for carbon capture, utilization, and storage within the electricity sector, because there are going to be some projects that folks want to get out there and start. And right now, if we don't get additional regulatory clarity, and it could be that the commission is planning on saying yes on this issue. This is the spirit of the of bringing this out and talking about it, is that to see what y'all think, let's think about some language we can all support, and the commission may have actually already been planning on doing that. I don't know. But this gives them some additional comfort that at least this advisory committee took it up and considered it. Yeah, Don.
Is your issue here revolve around the K-list and the K-list language?
Well, no, I think the issue is across the board. Is there an adequate environmental rule? I've called out the statutory language in K to show that when the legislature has actually spoken about, I mean, if you look at about what an environmental rule or regulation is, okay, so if you look at the statute, there's really no guidance given about what an environmental rule or what meter exceeds means. The only place you actually see any guidance is in this language in 16. It specifically says,
because we all agreed that the commission was the best place to make those determinations, some stuff, including your clients, was not getting positive use determinations. So K-list got created. You and I now have a disagreement on what that means. That is now going to be litigated in court, because you've brought, I think you're, I don't know if you're the actual attorney who's doing it, but it's now going to court, right?
Yeah, let me be clear. Stop you right there. This is not related to that. 16, okay, is carbon capture, utilization, storage. There was no CCUS projects. This is carbon capture and anthropogenic sequestration.
I understand.
This is not HRSGs.
But you're really after carbon dioxide is a pollutant, and any project to reduce carbon dioxide should be considered.
So considered exactly is the magic word, right? Should be considered. Doesn't mean it's going to get it. There could be a lot of reasons why the commission wouldn't do it. But even if we aren't prepared to give that kind of comfort, I'm saying with regard to CCUS, the legislature has explicitly recognized that sequestering carbon, there were no applications for this, Don, just to answer your question. Nobody got told no, and so they passed the K-16 item. K-16 is what CCUS is at power plants and refineries. It's not these other projects. So at minimum, I'd like us to give the commission some comfort that I certainly think a majority, at least, of the committee should be able to agree that we are at a point in time in the history of the regulation of carbon dioxide where there is an adequate rule for purposes of CCUS. I think there's an adequate rule for any GHG project. If y'all don't want to agree with that, that's fine. I think it's clear legally there is. But that's not to say that the commission is going to give positive use determinations for production equipment and for other situations. I mean, this is really just rifle shot, what is and what is not an environmental rule. Okay, you don't have to get into a debate about what the K-list is or is not. I'm talking about the criteria for gatekeeper. Okay, I mean, the debate about K-list.
Stuff not getting past the gatekeeper right now that you think should?
Air Products was rejected on the basis that an inadequate environmental rule was in place to support a CCUS project at a refinery. And the commissioners made that determination because, you know, the facts before them were, and the law before them was, in October of 2013 when they deliberated, I think that was the agenda date somewhere in there, the state of Texas was still litigating fully whether carbon dioxide is a pollutant and whether or not we like it, and I know the commission staff, you know, agrees at some visceral level. The fact is that we got some good things out of the UARG opinion from my perspective, but what we didn't get is a reversal of that issue. So the Supreme Court has basically said EPA can regulate GHG as a pollutant.
So does that mean if that same Air Products were to come now?
I think it should qualify, but I'm looking to help make it more clear, at least what mm-hmm. the advisory committee views the status should be, because, you know, the question may come up, and if you look at the legal briefing in Air Products, you can see why I'm concerned about this. The legal briefing in Air Products was about, well, is there a sector-specific requirement to control? Case in point, Cyrus, there's no 111 rule for the refineries yet, right? Is the commission going to say, well, without a 111 rule, we're not going to let refineries CCUS? And for power plants, do I have to cite to a proposed 111D rule? Or isn't it enough that carbon dioxide is regulated as a pollutant, and you're going out there and you're doing CCUS? I would submit that the statute and the fact that the legislature, in the only place in the entire statute is articulated kind of what an environmental regulatory trigger should be, has addressed that specific issue, that if carbon dioxide is regulated as a pollutant. It doesn't say regulated as a pollutant for a specific sector, right? But, you know, there may be many other reasons why the commission may ultimately not recognize 100% or 50% or even any percent. I'm just saying that we should get beyond the environmental rule gatekeeper as the reason these things would get kicked out.
So you're asking that the advisory committee make a recommendation to the commission on how they interpret their existing rules in a particular application?
Yeah, I'm suggesting that we, if we have a lot of interests around the table here, can all agree that a certain set of, you know, hypotheticals meet the statutory and constitutional test. That's the.
Let me clarify. I don't think it's within our scope to weigh in on a specific application. I think that's where you're going.
You said that before.
But I think it does have wide application.
It has huge wide application. Anybody who's considering whether to.
I get less comfortable with wide application when you start saying wide application, because now I don't understand the ramifications.
Well, I mean, whether or not you're comfortable, I think that the fact is that legally speaking, carbon dioxide is regulated as a pollutant by EPA. And so people who come in with carbon dioxide reduction proposals should be getting through the gate. Whether or not the commission issues a positive use determination is a different issue. Okay?
And to just follow up, maybe if we took up as part of this discussion four and asked what does this mean that the USA EPA has approved the SIP for greenhouse gases. Who does it actually apply to? You know, give us some context.
Okay. Well, let me try that first, and I'm certainly not an expert on BACT for any waste sources, but previously EPA's regulations that you all put your equipment in for applied to sources that
new sources,
went over
right?
the amount of CO2 or greenhouse gases that could be emitted based upon EPA's regulations. The Supreme Court basically said no. You can't regulate solely on the basis of carbon dioxide emissions, but if you are in any way source for other emissions, then you can regulate those CO2 emissions from that industry. I think is that right. good enough?
That's right. Yeah. from anybody who would otherwise need a permit. I mean, a federal permit. So it's not necessarily industry specific. It could be a free scale.
Sure.
If they were in any way source.
It's for sure facility specific, because there are semiconductor companies out there, even in Texas, that are any way sources that have federal permits for VOCs or for HAPS or some other pollutant that are required now to put in BACT for carbon dioxide. So those companies would be getting positive use determinations for the exact same identical equipment in the same exact situation that my particular facility would no longer get an exemption for, because we're not in any way source anymore.
But aren't there are two tests, right? It's whether you have another pollutant that's regulated that you have to get the permit for, and then there's a threshold question, right? You have to.
Well, the tailoring rule was struck down, so the threshold is the de minimis level has not been redefined yet.
True, that's true.
So there will be a de minimis threshold above which you have to emit CO2, but it will be a de minimis threshold, and EPA has not rearticulated what that is.
Okay.
Now, for the application that you were talking about that we denied for the carbon sequestration project, and it gets to what you're saying, but just to make sure you understand, that facility wasn't subject to BACT. They weren't subject to BACT. So it gets back down to an industry-specific type of determination. There was just, from our perspective, there was no rule that specifically applied to that facility. Mm-hmm. And I realize that's part of your
discussion. It is true. I mean, and for those that are concerned that this is too specific a discussion for one application, it's important. This isn't going to resolve, until the law is more clear, all applications, right? It's going to need to be somebody who would otherwise be being governed by BACT at some point, or, God forbid, if 111D gets finalized, the whole damn electric fleet. But, I mean, it is an issue that's before us, because these are important projects, you know, for people that Cyrus represents. They're important in a significant way. For the people that I represent, we're looking for regulatory certainty, and some of them are going to want to get out in front and do it, and this is a sizable impact. I mean, whether or not it gets positive use treatment, or at least considered, it is the kind of thing, and you've heard it from Robert, that gets factored into decisions about whether you're going to do something. It does. It's the reality of it.
But just to be clear, getting back to the discussion of four, if you are an industry that would be subject to being required to getting a greenhouse gas permit because you're already regulated for other permits and you meet any de minimis standard and you have to do BACT for GHG, whatever that equipment is to do that BACT would likely get a positive use determination since Texas is now running that program.
Yes, I think that would be correct. The situation that I think still is being discussed is what if you're another industry that's not necessary? What if you're not in any way source? How does that apply to you?
Yeah, specifically, even the same industry, just a different company doing the exact same process, who, because of the size of their operation, isn't in any way source.
Right. So in your example, because you don't emit more than a certain number of tons of VOC or NOx, you're not then subject to that those
right, or even permits. On that to that end, because Austin's not a non-attainment area, our thresholds for VOC and NOx are quite a bit higher than, say, someone in Dallas.
Right.
So they might be a major source because of just the nature of where they are in the state. And so their equipment is given a positive use determination, but ours might not.
And so we're encouraging people to locate in Dallas rather than Austin, is what you're saying.
Potentially, or on the other hand, you know, now that there isn't really a regulatory driver behind having these abatement units installed, like I said, it's taking every ounce of effort to convince manufacturing to keep them installed and not just chuck them in a dumpster. And so if I can say, you know, if I have to go back and say, well, you know, we're going to have to pay property taxes on these also, you know, because now there's not really a driver behind them. I mean, they'll be gone next week.
And so, you know, how this all, whatever set of language that we all can get, you know, some comfort level, where the commission would take that. I mean, we don't currently have a definition of meet or exceed, and so it leaves the commission in a kind of a fact-specific situation every time, and so maybe that's where the commission goes, is it develops a definition for meet or exceed, or it at least develops a definition that it uses in its guidance. I'm not presupposing what the outcome is, but between now and our next meeting, y'all can be thinking about this. I can come up with some more examples, as can Robert and other industries, and just have a good deliberation about it, because I think that there's some, you know, there's certainly some environmental reasons why we would want to do this, but I think legally speaking and from an administration of the program standpoint, the commission would be well served if we gave them our input, non-binding as it is.
It's not meet or exceed, it's what is a pollutant that is the...
Well, it's really meet or exceed environmental rule, because some of these things, you know, this whole idea of you know, what exceed means, right? So his example of a VOC... Okay, we know VOC is a regulated pollutant. There's all kinds of regulations that govern it, so the commission's not going to be all that hard grappling with it. But in CO2, it's a really interesting question.
Because
if there was a CO2 threshold, let's just say de minimis, okay? I mean, it's a really interesting question. If you install something to keep you below the de minimis level, so you don't even have to do BACT, GHG BACT, I mean, I wouldn't want to have their job of trying to figure out whether that is meet or exceed an environmental rule. And so I'm looking for us to give some input. I believe it should be, because you step back from the minutia of the debate and say, you know, they're putting in equipment, okay, that's controlling a pollutant that a whole regulatory regime has been developed and now the courts have allowed to move forward.
We shouldn't
be debating it.
Well, I agree with you, but it's not the meet or exceed. It's that they have not defined carbon dioxide.
Well, they have.
They
clearly have. The endangerment fine, I mean, Cyrus and I, the one thing we might be able to agree with, CO2 is a pollutant under the Clean Air Act, and the Supreme Court has confirmed it.
And I think the rules just haven't caught up with that is our real problem.
Well, no, the Supreme Court has affirmed EPA's rule. And if you look at the language of the statute, if EPA passes a rule regulating carbon dioxide as a pollutant...
If you're not under BAC, when you file your application, you can't refer to BAC in a reg, because he's going to go, well, you're not even in BAC.
Right.
So, and I understand what Don's saying. You don't want this thing to get too big, or where now then you sort of done more. So if you can...
We can just narrow it to the specific examples that we know exist,
if
right.
If you did something that is required by BAC, however you were not regulated by BAC, you would still qualify.
Or exceeded BAC.
All right.
I mean, that's where we get into why exceed is important, because you may not know. I mean, the fact is that, let's just take like the generator. We don't know. I mean, we have a lot of trust that a sane methodology is going to be used, and TCEQ's got proven track record of doing a good job running a permit program. But, you know, maybe there's more litigation. Maybe EPA takes an even more aggressive step. Maybe they disapprove our SIP again. Who knows, right? If we decide to go a little bit more than what we think will be mandated, that to me is exceed. What does exceed mean if it doesn't mean that? And so, but yeah, your point is, and to what you're commenting about, Don, I do think that it makes sense to refine this to situations where the facts and law, we see them, we don't necessarily have to all agree that anything that affects GHG should be on the table right now. I think we should at least be able to come to some agreement. If you're in any way source and you're going to have backed subject, or your source is going to be subject to backed at some point, that's enough, right? Or if you have a proposed rule that's looking to regulate your entire sector and you do something, 111D, right, and you install something, it wouldn't be effective until that rule was finalized, but that person that goes out and does that, you know, should be getting at least in the door. Again, this is just an eligibility criteria. And so I think there's wisdom, Michael, to stepping back from just anything that controls GHG in the spirit of consensus here and focusing on the things that, that maybe the commission would have a little bit more comfort with, so it's of use to them within the areas of regulatory world that we know are going to be governed by this Texas process.
Procedurally, do you envision, assuming we all come to agreement on some of, or one or more of these ideas in writing, do we just bless it as a committee, or do you think some of this is eligible for actual rulemaking in the administrative code, and would the staff prefer that to be the route, or are we just talking about a consensus among the committee? And if it's just a consensus, is the staff going to feel obligated to follow that? What's been our history on that?
I think the committee advises the commission, and I don't think the staff here weigh in on how you choose to provide that advice to the commission. We would make recommendations to the commission as we do. I don't think we can give you a preference of how to.
Sorry to do this. Would you be on record? Sorry.
I was trying to distinguish the staff here and the commission of commissioners of TCQ who implement the statute and adopt the rules of the commission.
But if these are not getting through right now, and we reach an agreement that some of them should, staff is kind of a gatekeeper. So if we don't have some policy that changes y'all's mind before it gets to the commission, that would be a problem for industry, I would assume. So, Michael, do you envision this going as a rule or just as something we agree to as a committee?
I think it probably does need to be a rule. I mean, I think if you think about the fact that there is no definition of meet or exceed, right, we don't have one, and it may be. I said commission should clarify because out of deference to what the commission, the general counsel, and the legal division and the technical staff all prefer, I'd like not to be superimposing views about how they do it. We're looking for whatever clarity. Sometimes, Bennett, that comes in the form of guidance, and that's more than adequate. We issue a lot of guidance in this program to resolve ambiguities, right? Sometimes the commission decides, yeah, it needs to be in a rule. My gut reaction problem is that this probably needs to be in a definition of meet or exceeds, okay? But at least the language, which again is non-binding, that we could all get some comfort around, we could hand off and have a discussion, and you know, maybe in that meeting or in a future meeting, Bennett, we all agree, well, let's add to that recommendation that they should do it as a definition of meet or exceed. At this point, I just want to actually try to narrow the situations that we would look to advise on, and then let them give. I would think maybe that staff might give us some sense if we come up with a recommendation of, well, we I don't know how they whether they feel comfortable about this, but that this could, if it's going to work as good as it could work, it should be back and forth. There could be a dialogue, right? There could be a staff's like, you know, you guys don't even think about this word right here is going to open up a Pandora's box. I'd like us to have that dialogue after the next meeting, and we all have a further discussion about that. But if they choose not to, that's not a problem. It's just it would probably help us with that, what is the next step? Because I wouldn't want to just throw a petition for rulemaking over the fence and then put a burden on the staff to come up with its own language. Ultimately, the commission executive director recommends to the commissioners proposed rules, right? And we can help advise, and they can...
The point I was trying to make is the staff here are not in a position to... Right. Tell the advisory committee what or what not you can advise the commission. And so we're available for those discussions, but we're not
right.
Discouraging that advice.
Right. And procedurally, Bennett, in the past, when Bob has put something before us for a recommendation, he's communicated that to the commissioners in a letter. Is that right, Bob? Is that what you've done?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. So, and sometimes that's been in the context of proposed rules, so it was received into the docket as a comment. Sometimes it was outside the context of a proposed rule, and it kind of made its way into something. I don't really know the total history. I envision here, because we're not in a rulemaking right now, that this would be something that they might consider for the next rulemaking.
Was excuse me, was there a time we made comment on something outside of a rulemaking?
Seems like it.
Well, we've no, I don't think so. We're required at least every 3 years. Didn't say we can't do it more than once every 3 years. But, no, I'm not aware of that.
Yeah, I guess the Valero situation was in a rulemaking, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I was thinking that. That was what I was thinking, is the Valero situation might have been in advance of a rulemaking.
And I think we got ourselves a little pear-shaped around one of those communications where we built into the – it was built into the communication – elements that were not agreed to at this table. And I think that's something we ought to avoid by making sure we have the communications in front of us in their totality.
Agreed.
And we can prevent that in the future. I like the idea if there's a problem, and it sounds like there is a problem, I think we could all agree upon fixing around the timing of this, like in your situation. I don't want to see good pollution control equipment without productive value taxed just because of a technicality, right? And so addressing that is something I think we could definitely support, and doing it in the context of rulemaking, if we're going to go in the context of advising on how to interpret rules, that might be appropriate, but I'd sure like to hear staff talk to us about that. That's new for us. Excuse me. But doing it in the context of a rulemaking is really clear for us. And I think clear for the staff as well, especially when we talk about, well, we advise the commission. And I see the commission is doing two things, adopting rules and then making decisions on particular instances in those rules. And we know we were trying to avoid the latter. So,
you know, in the conversation in the last rulemaking, there were some things that we all agreed, you know, were kind of beyond the rulemaking. This was one of them, right? At least the things that had been teed up by the proposed rule. And in the discussion with some of the staff, the question did arise, if it's something you think really does need to happen and needs to happen before the next triennial review, is the right procedural mechanism to petition for a rulemaking? Because there's really only a couple of ways rules get started, right? The staff thinks it needs to get done, and the executive director makes a recommendation to the commission, and the commission proposes a rulemaking. Or they get petitioned to do a rulemaking. I'm not looking to turn this into a formalistic process, but the discussion informally with staff at the time was, it's an option. I mean, it's an option. It could be the way we communicate to the commissioners is that, I certainly believe there are a number of industries that see enough of an urgency to have this recommendation take the form of a petition, but I didn't want to get out in front of it procedurally about where this goes. I hear you, though, Don, about your concern about what the communique looks like, so if y'all will kind of give me any email language changes or suggestions, I'll digest those and I'll put it in the form of a draft letter to the commissioners so that what Bob actually sends is something y'all have seen ahead of time. Is that a good idea?
I think it comes through the committee and we vote on it.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
And I would tell you on this, I don't want to belabor a discussion. Some of the discussion here and some of this recommendation, to me, I'm still scratching my head on, as I haven't identified the problem. In other words, this seems more than is necessary to address the situation that we kind of are reaching some consensus around. And that concerns me.
Well, I mean, like I said, I didn't want to give you an exhaustive list of examples, but I will follow up with everybody and maybe even with a table of some sort giving you some examples, and I welcome other industry participants to help populate that table because there are specific examples for each one of these. They came from somewhere.
Yeah, and then maybe we can use that to start developing the language.
Okay.
And just as a reminder, you mentioned possible rules. The definitions is in 17.2. So that's a possible option if we put exceeds in there or have whatever term we want to use. 17.2. Any other discussion? Any comments, concerns from TCEQ staff regarding all this discussion? All right. Okay. Then, as Mike said, he will try to pull together something in the form of a recommendation for our next committee meeting.
Yeah, I'll just craft it as a recommended letter that we can all vote on. But no reason to be having to wordsmith it then. So I'll send it ahead of time, and you know, it will be based on this language. So unless I get some, hey, I don't like that word, or after you see the examples, you think it doesn't fit the examples, I just would ask that some email input be provided so that the product that we bring before the committee next time is actually ready for a vote, as opposed to, I mean, there's always tweaks we can do at the meeting, but if we can accomplish that via email, that'd be, I think, better.
Okay. Are there applications pending right now that this recommendation would affect? And if so, I echo Don's concern that we might be viewed as trying to tell the commission how to vote on something. It might be better to craft the language as a new section to 17.2, whether we're petitioning for not. In other words, the committee's consensus is that there ought to be something like this that defines meet or exceed with respect to timing. I'm just nervous about being perceived as our committee, you know, telling the commission how to vote on a pending application, and how we finesse that, because that's not what we want to be doing, obviously, and nor do we want to be perceived as doing that. So
I'm not aware of anything that's pending, and it's not driven from my perspective by that. And in fact, that's probably a pretty good idea to put in the letter.
Okay.
Is to say that we're not, you know, the committee doesn't have any individual application in mind in considering this issue, because this is really a proactive measure.
I don't have anything pending. I mean, there's quite a few I'd like to submit, but nothing pending at the moment. So.
Okay. All right. We'll move forward with that. Any other issues or any other discussion on this point? All right, we'll move to old business. I also should pause for Charles. You're on the phone. Do you want to comment on anything we've said?
No, I'm still kind of taking it.
Okay. All right. Any new business? This is a heads up as a reminder. We're required to elect a new chair every year. So it'll be, sometimes we've done it, and if I'd have thought about it, I'd have put it on this agenda so it'd be effective starting in January so I could plan the next meeting. But we can certainly put it on the February agenda for re-election.
Under new business?
For next time or for this, I'm okay if you want to bring it up this time, but I don't want to push
actually,
that.
I'm moving to the. I'm trying to bring something up under new business.
Okay.
Other than that,
all right.
And I don't know. This might be related to what Mike's been talking about, but I just was watching testimony by TCEQ. Staff and one of the commissioners, and forgive me, I forget the commissioner, to the House Committee on Environmental Resources, I believe it is. Mike, this is the one where you...
Environmental Regulation.
Environmental Reg. And he mentioned perhaps the need for changes to the Prop 2 program, he being the commissioner from TCEQ, based upon the new EPA carbon rules. So I'm bringing that up here because it seems if that is the case, maybe we ought to try to explore what he meant by that and the context of that, and maybe this group can be someone that helps shape anything that needs to happen there. Yes.
This is Minor Hibbs, TCEQ staff, and I wasn't at that meeting, but I am a little bit aware of what I believe the chairman possibly said, but the new greenhouse gas regulations are very wide ranging, and they get.
So you're not referring to the BACT requirement for new facilities. You're referring to the clean power.
I'm referring to, I think, 111D regulations for existing facilities primarily. I mean, it covers the whole industry, energy industry, rather than specific plants, and it's going to be mind shattering how to comply with the regulations. It's not adding a piece of pollution control equipment over here on a utility power plant to control carbon dioxide, because there isn't that, except for maybe CCS to store the carbon dioxide. But it's energy efficiency, it's reducing demand, and I think what was in his mind was, How's a Prop 2 program going to address that? And it's something that would be perfect for you all to address and to provide.
And that gets at, Mike, the early discussion about wind turbines and solar. And I am, let me just say straight up, I am not in favor of giving. I'm in favor of wind and solar. I'm not in favor of saying the purpose of wind and solar is to reduce carbon dioxide and therefore they shouldn't be on the tax rolls. But one could submit a state plan to meet the carbon dioxide requirements and say part of the way we're going to do there is we're naturally going to increase our use of wind and solar. So that, you know, then it gets into this, you know, it's a state plan to meet carbon dioxide, and we're going to use more wind and solar. So does that mean those are pollution control equipment? You know, I don't think they are, but I'm not sure how to get around that.
Yeah, I think, so, first of all, I'm glad you brought it up, Don, because it's a very important consideration. I hadn't even thought about the implications. So what I would suggest, or at least what my preference is right walking into this draft letter, is that we make it clear that we're not weighing in on the question or sanctioning that anything other than source controls, pollution prevention and controls at sources is, you know, I'm not going to write in a way that creates problems for you, Cyrus, from a legal perspective.
Similarly, right, one of the building blocks, the proposed building blocks, is you increase the requirements on energy efficiency programs, which we're supportive of. But again, does that mean if Encore increases their budget for insulation, that all that insulation comes off the tax? You know, I mean,
it's real complicated. I'm not trying to turn this into certainly do not want this to be interpreted as we're going for that, right? And at the same token, I don't want to turn it into an absolute war against anybody who would make that argument, but I will craft it in a way and make it clear that this recommendation, this set of language, is not saying that. And is not supportive of that.
That's on your letter. And then we still need to kind of grapple with the chairman's...
Yeah. What he needs from us or could help from us. And I mean, it may be that we all agree with the principle that these things do need to be source-specific. And that's the advice he would like or would benefit or would appreciate getting from us. And there probably is consensus on that.
He has a broader responsibility than just us. And I'm sure he knows that we're going to be specific because it's, you know, tax exemption's got to be specific. Mm-hmm. And I, from what I've heard about his comments, which isn't much, sounds like he'd be interested in hearing our input from the things we've been discussing.
I have no hesitation. I'll craft a sentence or two to articulate what I believe and what I've heard from Cyrus, and I think you'd agree, Don, that this program was not designed to give tax exemption to things going on in the world, okay, in the electricity sector that might reduce GHGs. I mean, that seems to me a bridge too far, that if somebody really promoting that idea needs to go to the legislature to get that passed. That's not what, and I would support ratcheting that down right now so that the chairman would know at least what our committee's view is, that, you know, you don't have to weigh in on whether it's a good idea if the legislature decides to do it, but as it relates to the law that exists right now that got passed and the constitutional amendment that changed, was it rational that they would envision the construction of windmills or energy efficiency programs in our homes to qualify as pollution control equipment? I think not, and we probably could say that.
Don or Minor, do you know the date of that time? Maybe go online and
29th and 30th.
See it again?
We can find it. And in truth, it was a comment in passing.
Yeah.
Okay.
He did not go into detail. He did not elaborate on it. I can almost remember a paraphrasing of it being he had spent a lengthy amount of time discussing the new EPA rules that you guys refer to technically with different provisions, and all I know is that. He talked about that specifically, and then he said, and by the way, this has implications to our Prop 2 program, and the legislature may need to address that and give us some direction on that.
Yep,
I'm not sure he said much more than that. And so, you know, it makes me think maybe he's thinking that the current statute might implicate them to feel they should do something beyond what everyone had thought about.
Or at least get asked.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think we should anticipate they'd be asked. I mean, yeah. I think we expect taxpayers and we respect taxpayers for pushing to see if their property is exempt, if there's a possible exemption. I don't think we hold that against taxpayers, right? It's a different environment than in pollution, where if someone says, I want to pollute every bit I can, well, we don't respect that. But on taxes, we respect a taxpayer pushing for every exemption they could possibly qualify for, and it's up to government to draw clear, solid lines and say, this is what it is. And only if you go across this line do you get that. And we don't mind you pushing at the line. Mm-hmm. It's up to us to have a firm hold on that. And so that's what I get concerned with. Maybe he perceives that line is going to be blurred by this. And this is something we have always felt is a concern with the program, right? And a natural concern with the program that we just have to wrestle with. It's a good program, but that's a part of it, is we have to wrestle with changing technology, changing regulatory schemes, and keeping the program within the bounds we all wanted it to be.
Right. And I'd agree with Miner's characters. I think it seemed like a passing comment, but it's a nightmare that he's dealing with. And the Prop 2 program is tricky, and so everybody's real clear about specifically from a legal perspective what's at stake, maybe that the commissioner chairman's thinking about. Is the EPA in this proposal under 111D is basically regulating the entire electricity sector as a source.
Right.
Okay. And so we are obliged to not just go outside the fence to comply, but they're going outside the fence of power plants to define the standard. So they're saying, does it really matter what a power plant can do inside the fence? If we can do all these other things, right, then, you know, that needs to be factored in, and that's what actually is going to be required. Not specifically, but the number you can get to. And so very logical that the chairman would be wondering what the roll-off implications are if, in fact, EPA is legally treating our entire sector as a source, because if I'm a windmill operator, I may come in and say, hey, the source is no longer inside the fence. The source is the power sector. Why wouldn't I be a control technology?
Even a transmission line that makes...
Transmission line that connects the two.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of investment out there that the industry makes to produce and deliver electricity. And making changes in a way that emits less emissions can be a lot of different things. And if that's what they're saying, it's just we want the entire industry to have less, and they're making all sorts of changes elsewhere. Mm-hmm. If the argument is, and I think, like I just said, if we can anticipate that property owners will say, hey, TCEQ, does that qualify me?
Right.
And if TCEQ feels, the commission feels unsure about their ability and status to say no, I think that's something that everyone needs, the legislature needs to understand. We all need to understand, and if we can all agree here in this committee to tell them, no, we think the rules and the standards still apply to differentiate what is pollution control equipment there and what is not, well, then that could go a long way to helping him.
Yeah, I mean, and it's somewhat analogous to Valero. If you think about the argument there was, you know, low sulfur fuel, it's a requirement, anything we do to lower sulfur. I mean, it was even more direct there.
Right.
And but we figured out a way to give the commission some language that showed that it's not the quality of the product that is the environmental benefit, right? And, right. And maybe there's something similar we could do here. So I'll give that some thought and include it, because you know, there's only so much bandwidth the chairman and the commissioners are going to have to listen to our advisory committee. We might want to put it all in one letter.
Yeah. Okay. Good discussion.
Did you want to do the chairman today, so you'll be ready next time?
It's up to the. I'm available, as I say every year. I'm not running for office, but I'm available to continue. But I'll just leave it at that. If anyone else is interested, it might be a good idea to wait, and we'll.
Didn't we just reappoint you recently? Am I imagining that?
It's been a year.
Right.
Then, yeah.
I make the nomination.
Second. All right.
I move that we close nomination.
What is the nomination? Let's be clear.
Yeah.
Bob Adair, continue to be the chairman.
Okay. Second. All right.
And I'll move that we close nominations and we appoint by proclamation Chairman Adair for the
20. Question. Can we do that without it being on the agenda? I have no problem with you, Bob, whatsoever.
I don't know. That's why I didn't want to push it.
I think you just took the straw poll. Gives you a good indication what would happen.
Is there anyone on the committee that's not here or listening or involved? This looks like we have a pretty good turnout.
I mean, we got Charles on the phone, and we got everybody else here.
Everybody's here, yeah.
Well, then if everybody's here, then no one doesn't have notice, right? That would be my only concern. If someone found out, oh, you all appointed the chairman. I was going to run for that, right? I was going to put myself up for that, and they're not here. Since everyone's here, I don't see a downside with doing it now.
I don't either.
Okay, I'll go with the will of the committee. We have a motion and a second for Bob Ada to chair for 2015, and there was a motion for...
Well, strictly speaking, sorry to be Robert's Rules of Order guy, you probably ought to take a vote on closing nominations. I move that we close nominations.
Okay, good point. Good point.
Second.
All right, we have a motion and a second to close nominations. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. Now we will vote on the actual motion.
Yeah, so I think the appropriate motion would be a motion that we appoint Bob Adair by acclamation.
I'll second it.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion passes. Okay. Any?
Nothing like being railroaded again, Bob.
I hear the Senate might need a new parliament.
Right. Any other business? Any? Not that we have a lot of public. Mr. LaBalle, you have anything to say to us? I was kidding. If any other business?
I always bring up, since Mr. LaBalle is here, I always bring up the new requirements on gas wells And again, whether we feel like, since those are going into effect this year, whether we feel like we've got all the language we need in the guidelines and rules that we can positively determine pollution control equipment that's required under the whatever that XXX000 NSPS requirements are. Just sort of a question to staff whether there's anything we need to do as an advisory committee, assuming that rule gets implemented.
For those of us unfamiliar, explain it.
Well, basically, the EPA passed, they reviewed and passed new regulations on new wells that are drilled to try to better control emissions during the...
So is this to try to stop flaring?
Not initially stop flaring, but, yeah, it helps in various areas of different emissions with gas processing and the initial drilling and completion of the well. So I think the answer is probably we have everything we need in the pre-approved list. That is not going to be an issue, but just looking for any, if you need any guidance from us on that.
And I can ask the question of staff, but right now I'm not aware of any of any guidance that we need. I think most of the equipment, as far as I'm aware of, is probably add-on equipment that the program
already deals with.
Generally normally handles.
Well, maybe y'all can check and let us know next meeting.
All right. Any other business to come before us? I'll accept a motion to adjourn then.
I so move.
All right, we have a motion to adjourn. I don't think motion to adjourn requires a second, but anyway, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those against, no. All right, we are adjourned at 11:32. And for the record, I should have mentioned earlier that Cyrus came in at 10:10, I believe.
I think it was 10:09 to be.
Okay, there you go.
How are you?
Thank you.
Ha 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 ha.